Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. In the second half of the program, we're going to be speaking with Andy Worthington. He's author of the book, The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. Right now, I'd like to welcome Glennis Carl. She's the author of the book, Hold My Hand, A Mother's Journey, and she will be speaking this Saturday, the 15th of March, at 3 o'clock at a reading and book signing at Body of Santa Fe, right across the street from where we are, pretty much at 333 Cordova Road. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, and thank you for inviting me.
It's wonderful to have you here, and the occasion is your memoir, which is a story really that every parent dreads. The phone rings in the middle of the night. Somebody asks if you are the mother of a certain person. You are. Your son has had an accident. He's in a coma in a distant country. Tell us what happened.
Okay. At first, you're like in shock, and you wonder what happened. You ask them, well, what happened? And often the police can't tell you what happened.
Because they don't know.
That's right. They don't. You get little bits of the story. I was told that he was in surgery, that I should call the hospital. I started to call the hospital. Couldn't get a reply at first. Couldn't speak to the doctor that I was supposed to be able to talk to. And eventually, I did get many calls back 3 hours later. So during those 3 hours, I knew I had to get there. But at the same time, I didn't know anything, didn't know too much.
So you made your way to Australia, and the book is full of ways in which you talked your way into doing impossible things and doors open for you. And you found your son in a coma. First of all, how did he get that way? What, he had an accident, but was it ever determined exactly what happened?
No. The doctors did say it looked like he'd been attacked because he had a black eye on one side, but no scratches, no other punches. And whoever it was had pushed him, and he fell and hit the side of his head, and he lay there for many, many hours.
And you found him in a coma, and you basically sat by his side until you saw the first flicker of his eyelid moving. Were people surprised that he woke up at all?
Yes, yes. Many, many doctors came to me and said they were totally surprised. And in the end, they were lecturing on him because they lectured on four young men that were brought in within that week. And mostly, he was the one that survived, and he was the one that was supposed to not even make it to the hospital. And he was able to talk, and his sense of humor and his character was very much intact.
So you nursed him. Yeah, I mean,
yes.
How did you know what to do?
Instinct.
Really? Because yeah. There are some things that you did. I mean, you know, you wrote words on cards and held them up, and you did all sorts of things that one would think that you were a trained rehabilitation nurse or something.
No, I hadn't been trained. I had had some early childhood training. My first job in America, when I first came as an immigrant, was in Detroit with the first Head Start. So maybe from making games up and putting letters on boards, that came to me. But I'm not sure. I just wanted to know what he wanted, what he knew. Was he still in there? Because he couldn't talk. He had his trachea in.
And so when he came back and he was able to talk, what was his experience of life like?
Well, first of all, I said, not first of all, but after several weeks, I said, Scott, are you afraid to die? Because he came so close many times. And he answered me and he said, I love living. And here was a young man that had been a great athlete and he could only move one arm, he couldn't turn over, but his wit was still the same and his determination that he'd had since he was a little boy was still intact.
When you say he came close to death many times, what do you mean?
Oh, he could not take antibiotics. He was allergic to every antibiotic on the planet. He developed septicemia several times. They said, this is it. Even with antibiotics, he has it so badly that he wouldn't survive anyway. And he kept getting better. There were many, many miracles. And that's what I have to call them, miracles, because he kept getting better. And then he developed the same set of symptoms in England after we were thrown out after 2 years in Australia. And he did it again.
Now, it's interesting. You talked your way into Australia because you need a visa to go to Australia. And
yes.
You were able to get in without one through just talking your way in. And then you... your son's visa had expired because he was in a coma.
Yes.
And couldn't renew his visa. And the two of you were there illegally, and there were immigration doctors coming into the hospital with your son extremely sick and telling you guys you had to leave. You pulled all sorts of, what would you call it, rabbits out of a hat.
Yes, yes.
What did you do?
First of all, there was one immigration doctor said there's no way that he can travel. So the other doctor said, well, there's no way he can have any rehabilitation in the hospital. You've fallen through the cracks. You're here illegally. So we can't make any exceptions. And I said, okay, one of you say he's too ill to travel. The other one are telling me I can't stay. What should I do? And they said, well, we don't know. I said, all right, I'll make the decision for you. I'll rent a place, and I'll take him home. And the day I was taking him home, I realized I couldn't even lift him. So I got him into the little flat that I had rented. First thing, I couldn't get him out of the taxi. So I had to run and stop some people on the street and say, could you possibly help me carry him in? And the first thing I said was, do you have a bad back? And so that stopped them in their tracks. And they looked up and they said, well, why? I said, because it's going to be a job lifting him in down the steps and through the doorway. And then when I was alone, I thought, my God, what am I going to do? And it came to me that I would run up and down the street writing little pieces of paper out, saying that I would accept anyone. And over 400 people came to help. That was the amazing thing. That was the miracle.
And you were on television and radio and in the newspapers, and the immigration people were getting phone calls and
yes.
And letters, and they're like, who is this woman who's been in Australia for such a short time who's basically changing the system?
Yes. Like this little old lady and her husband, they wrote and said, well, we'll give them dinner once a week so they won't become a financial burden upon the state. And little children from the local school heard about it and sent them letters. Yeah.
And this case and the publicity that it generated actually succeeded in making some changes in the Australian medical system's treatment of head injury patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And in England, after I got thrown out, I was able to go to Parliament and open 24 beds for more head injured. And so... there was a lot of success came out of it for other head injured people. I'm usually not an aggressive person.
But when it comes to advocating for your son, did it feel like a new part of you was coming out that you hadn't known before?
Yes, sometimes I didn't know what was going to pop up to my mouth or where I was going to land up. I would say, oh, I need to go to this person or I need to go to that person. And then, as luck had it, it would be the right person would be in front of me.
It's a very interesting story. We're talking to Glenys Carl, author of Hold My Hand, A Mother's Journey, and she will be reading on Saturday at 3 o'clock and signing books at Body of Santa Fe on Cordova Road. What was Scott's condition like, and what was his awareness like during this period after he woke up, after he got out of the first hospital, and in this period of time when you were caring for him?
Okay, he went through a lot of pain, but he was determined, and his sense of humor helped him. He would pat people on the back, even if they were hurting him, and he thought nothing of picking up even a man's hand and giving it a kiss. through his struggle. He was in a lot of pain when he was doing these exercises, and it was constant. It was 6 hours a day with four people working his limbs.
Did he get significantly better?
Yes.
Did you feel that he was going to have, if not a full comeback, a livable, you know, workable life?
Yes. Yes, they said I'd never even get him sitting up. And within a month, I had him sitting up. They said he'd never move his legs. He could move his toes. Everything started to come alive. So I was really lucky. And then I wanted him to not have the four walls as a life. So I would say, well, what do you want to do today, Scott? And he said, oh, go to the beach. So we cut the legs off a chair and put some broomsticks on it, tied him in because he still could only use one arm, and carried him into the water. And he said, well, put me in the water. I don't care. And the big waves would come and he'd get wiped out. Of course, he was tied to this crazy chair that we made.
But before that, he'd been an early 20-something rugby player,
oh,
so he
yes.
was tough.
Yes, yeah. Tough and sensitive.
Yeah. So there's a sense, reading your book, that all sorts of doors just open for you by fate or coincidence. And for many other people who were parents of head-injured children, that did not happen. And some of those people called on you for help.
Yes, one woman, as a couple of days before I was leaving, she said, I'm going to chain myself to a gate that was going into some politician's house, and asked, would I go with her? And I said, I can't this time because I'm getting ready to leave. But I said, keep fighting. And I said, you don't have to chain yourself to a fence. Just keep talking. Just keep talking. And I felt very badly because I had had a lot of news media and television media, basically not because of the head injury and the shortness of programs, basically because of the visa issues.
Right. And yet your yeah. case generated so much publicity that people's generosity just came flooding toward
yes.
you, and you know, you had no money, and suddenly there was a plane ticket to get back to England, and
yes.
you know, you arrived in England and you didn't have enough money to rent a house, and somebody just walks out of an office at exactly the right time and asks you what you want, and
yes.
and suddenly you're there.
And the amazing thing was that house was for sale. Nobody looked at it in 2 years. And when I was ready to come back to America, three people offered to buy the house within a week.
Did you feel like there was, I mean, I hate to use the word, but yeah. divine guidance or something like that?
I did. I'd always believed, since a little child when I was four, fairies, spirits. I would talk to the sky not knowing who I was talking to. And, I really believed it during that time with Scott. And I believe it now. A lot of magic happens. A lot of magic happens when you open your heart, like my coming home connection right now. People are coming in, and they need to be needed.
What did it tell us about this? This is something that you have worked on recently, the coming home connection.
Yes. I've seen many gaps in the system.
Here in the United States?
Yes. I work in hospice, but I've seen gaps in the system with disabled children, the aging, different programs running out of money. So I decided, okay, I'm going to see if volunteers will come forward again. And many doctors and nurses have said, well, we'll give you 4 hours free help in someone's home. And I've trained over 60 people now in several months, and I have placed them. And it's not just emotional support. I really, with many other nurses, teach them a lot of hands-on in the area that they want to go into, whether it's a disabled person or a person in hospice.
Why did you decide to write a book about this whole process of your son's injury and illness and rehabilitation and the whole loss and the whole process?
A lot of people during this time said you need to write a book. And then I thought I owed it to the 400 people. 11 of them, by the way, went on to be physical therapists. Many went on to be nurses.
The people who helped you?
Yes. They still carry those programs out. The schoolboys that came forward, 2 went on to be neurosurgeons. And they still carry it out in England and Australia. And now the same thing is happening with the coming home. And so it's not about me. It's not about me at all. It's people do come together in times of adversity. Or I believe that.
Did the process of writing the book and its publication, how do I say this, put your relationship to your suffering in a different perspective?
Yes, it did. And even that was easy. After many, many years, I thought, okay, I should write the book for my grandchildren. And then I thought, no, I should write it for the people that helped me. And the people need to know not to give up when tragedy hits, or when tragedy hits, look at the gifts that have been left. Look at the gifts. And so even that fell into place. An agent took it on immediately, brought me over with half a book written, and I had 2 deals offered me, one by Macmillan and one by HarperCollins in England, which is amazing because I couldn't get a deal here.
And you couldn't get a deal here. We were talking about this before we went on the air today. Because you did lose your son at the end of this,
yes.
And the Americans wanted a happy ending.
Yes.
And the Europe,
I know. They didn't see the whole story of the 4 years struggle,
right.
All the good things that came out, all the people that went on to continue helping. And now with my coming home connection, that is a big legacy to Scott and all those people that started it.
Right.
I ran up and down the street, yes, gave the little notes out, but it was the people that came forward and the people that are coming forward right now.
So what you were doing, the Coming Home Connection, and you were, well, how closely are you involved? They're actually making a film of your book, of your memoir.
Yes,
are you involved with that?
I'm going to be consultant on it, and they're writing the script right now. And it's the same British company that produced The Queen. So again, I'm in great hands.
Would you like to read a little section from your book? We're talking to Glenys Carl, author of Hold My Hand, A Mother's Journey.
All right, this is a part when Scott was very ill. The doctor has just told me that there is no hope. Again, this is after 3 months. Oh, no, sorry, this is after 7 weeks. And the doctor said to me, it doesn't matter if your tears are flowing. He's your son, and you've fought hard to be with him this long, he says quietly. I understand your grief. I have 2 sons of my own. His hand gently squeezes my shoulder in support, but I'm afraid it's time to let go. I cried. His brother Jonathan is on his way, I plead. Scott can't die without seeing his brother. Please keep Scott alive just a little longer. Dr. Crotches is quiet for a long time, an eternity it seems. Tell your son to hurry. I collect another pile of coins for the payphone. You must hurry, I tell Jonathan. Scotty needs you. Can you leave tonight? Time seems to fly by, as it is making it impossible for Jonathan to arrive in time. But at the same time, each moment seems endless, eternal. Scott is still with me. I am still with him. I lie by his side, singing softly, hoping it gives him comfort. Hours pass, or has it been days? Maybe no more than minutes. Dr. Karch has come to my side and tells me Scott's vital signs are failing. The end is here. He hands me the papers granting permission to donate Scott's organs, and I sign. Then I hug my son a last time. I tell him how proud I am to be his mother. I tell him what a wonderful son he has been to me. My tears fall across his face. Doctors and nurses have quietly slipped in the room to gather round the bed. Many are openly weeping. I hear myself saying over and over, no, no, no. Mom, I swing around. Jonathan is standing in the door, blurry-eyed and disheveled. He throws his arms around me in a tight hug. I came as fast as I could, Mom. I hope I'm not too late. I frame his face in my hands. Oh, Jonathan, Scott is dying. Go tell him your goodbyes. Tell him you love him. Jonathan approaches the bed with a quiet reverence. The tubes have been removed. Scott lies under the white sheet, angelic in a deep slumber. Jonathan leans over and whispers in his brother's ear. I can't hear what it said. I won't ever ask him to tell me. It is his private moment. He continues to whisper, then gives a long, low whistle, the same whistle he and Scott have shared as children. The whistle that meant, it's okay to come out now, the coast is clear. Inexplicably, within minutes, Scott's vital signs begin to improve. His blood pressure strengthens, his pulse quickens, and slowly color returns to his face. The doctors who have gathered around are dumb with wonder. How could this be, the expression asks. The word miracle is whispered. And there you are.
And I mean, it's amazing that the doctors say goodbye now, and you say no. Do you feel like you, just your energy and your will for your son to live, played a role in his living?
Yes, I do. I had always told him that if he wanted to leave, he had my permission. But if he stayed, I would do everything in my power to do what was necessary. And his brother was such a big influence on him. He has two brothers. And Jonathan and he had such a bond that whistle from childhood somehow brought him back. And maybe Jonathan's energy, where mine was tired, began to take over.
His death seemed to be just medical, pure, unadulterated medical malpractice.
Yes, but I can't think of it as that way. In the end, I looked and I remembered all the nurses, all the physical therapists, all the doctors that had helped me through the 4 years. And I couldn't be bitter. I just couldn't find it within myself, because I remembered that the hospitals are so overcrowded. I had to think of it as an accident, that the tube had become dislodged. They're so overworked in hospitals all over the world. And our system is running out of money. So,
did you feel it, that it was somehow Scott's time to go?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I did. After a day or so, I thought, all right, he had walked. He had struggled, and he had walked. He had gone through many illnesses without the antibiotics, and this was his choice. He would have never been the same athlete that he was. He did not feel sorry for himself. We had changed some of the systems, all the people that came to help me. I couldn't be bitter.
So, as a mother, how do you move on in your life, or do you ever move on? I mean, the few people I know who have lost children, it really changes, and on some level you never get over it.
No, you don't. You don't. For a long time, it felt like my heart was still attached to him wherever he was. And when I first came to Santa Fe, I screamed out on the patio, well, where are you now? Nobody even knows my name here. And yet I knew he was gone. And then that's when the pain filled. And I knew for him And for myself and my other sons, I had to go on somehow. And luckily, I found my niche. I found my niche in hospice. And I had gained so much from my intuition. Whether I was guided, I don't know. I'm not an overly religious person. I'm spiritual, but I'm not overly religious, so know that right now. Everything always fell into place. I had to work very hard. I didn't know anybody here when I arrived.
How did you end up in Santa Fe?
All right, I had a friend who I knew in my late 20s, and he knew about Scott. And 6 months before Scott died, not knowing that he was going to die, I saw Bob, and I said, you know, how are you doing? He said, I'm having a house built in Santa Fe and can't live in it for 5 years. I said, oh, Bob, you need a house somewhere other than America. I mean, sorry, Los Angeles or New York. And I said, that's good for you. Not thinking anymore. I said, I've never been to Santa Fe, but I hear it's a lovely place. Scott died the week that that house was finished. Also, that week that Scott died, three people put an offer in for the house that I rented.
In
that
England.
Nobody had looked at that house for 2 years.
I mean, it's very strange. I mean, it really is enough to make you believe in angels, except that the angels are protecting some people but not others.
You think that?
Well,
yes.
I mean, just from your story, I think that. Because
they were definitely with me.
They were with you, but there were all these other people who had terrible luck, and, you know, they didn't have angels coming out of the closet at every turn at all.
No. No. No, I've been lucky. I'm lucky now.
One of the things that we talked to some hospice folks on the air not too long ago who'd made this wonderful movie about death and dying, and it's hard to imagine a wonderful movie about death and dying, but it really, really was, and I think you took part in this film.
Yes, I did.
And one of the things they said was that when you become a hospice nurse, if you were a hospital nurse before that, you really have to unlearn certain things. Because hospice is about dying, whereas hospital nursing is about keeping people alive at all costs.
Yes. You have to learn to surrender. Really surrender your own agenda, that you can't change things. And you can be there for that person and the family. And it's a very, very spiritual experience. And lots of times you're working with a family. And children from that family. And they're kept outside a lot of times. I always bring a child into the room and say, do you want to put some lavender on mommy or grandpa's hands? And you know, I don't know what it is, but they say, oh, please, can we do that? The fear has gone away. And I'll see them maybe 3 years later. And they say, do you remember you told me to get a stone from the garden and you let me rub some lavender on my mommy's or my grandfather or grandmother's hands? And that's the part that have stayed with them, which is the magic and the healing.
A lot of people say that the United States is a country that doesn't deal well with death. What is your, I mean, you're from Wales originally, you're a European citizen, I guess you would
yes.
say. What's your perspective on that?
I think you have to believe what, you know, why you're here. I think you have to believe why you're here, and we have to start talking to school children about death. I mean, the marketing company said that the book wouldn't do well here.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's an example.
Because he died.
Right.
We don't even want to face what's happening to the soldiers in the war. We don't want to do that. It's like death is death. We don't want to deal with sometimes the suffering that comes with death and how we can relieve that suffering. We have choices. We have choices. We're put in boxes.
How do you think school children, I mean, if you were teaching school children about death, what would you do?
Okay. I would explain to them in such a way that it's like a little bird sometimes that has fallen out of the nest, has died. Children are very magical. At first they will say, oh, that's sad, and then suddenly they want to bury it. They want to give it all the love that they can. I remember my grandchild, her little tiny mouse died. Wow, we went through this ritual. I didn't even have to say anything. She got her favorite little wooden box. The bird had to go in the box. She sat in front of the fire with it for an hour. Then she said, well, we can put it under the tree outside. So I dug a hole under the tree. Then she got the chimes and hung it on the tree. And then she said, oh, I'm going to wear black for a month. I said, where did you learn that, Megan? She said, oh, I heard someone say that in school. I said, you're going to wear black for a month? And I said, aren't you happy that you had that little tiny mouse? And don't you feel good that you've done all this ritual for him? And she said, oh, yeah, I'll get another mouse.
And did she?
Yes.
Very interesting. So the book is called Hold My Hand, A Mother's Journey. And you will be speaking, Glennis Carl, at Body of Santa Fe at 3 o'clock on Saturday. You've done a lot of publicity about this book since it came out. Is that right?
Yes, yes, and that's happened with Magica. It came out in Poland, and I was able to go there and worked with head injuries on the border towns that had no money, no hospital, no rehabilitation, and I told a village what to do, and it was just like some things were common sense. This one young man, I said, do you leave him in bed all day? And they said, no, we get him up for 2 hours. And I said, show him, show me. They sat him up and I said, would you like to sit like that for 2 hours? And I just told them how to reposition him. Nobody had told them. And then I found out he was making sounds and I knew he wanted to talk. So I said, through an interpreter, can you sing? And the interpreter asked, and I went, ha, ha, ha. And he started copying me. He couldn't say the words, but he had control over his voice that he could go, ha, ha, ha. So that meant that he may be able to talk if you started doing some exercises with his tongue, and his jaw was stiff from also being in a coma and not moved.
And all of these things are things that you just kind of figured out by observing and keeping your mind open.
Yes.
And have been able to teach them to others.
Yes, and not being afraid of the unknown. Not being afraid to try. It's better to try to do something than nothing. And so that's my philosophy, I think.
How did this whole process affect your other two sons?
It affected Samuel. Because he was unable to come many times, like Jonathan, because he was in America and we had no money to bring him over. And the first time he came over, he saw Scott in a coma, and in hindsight, he should have waited a little while. He was very ill. He came within 3 weeks. And it was funny, he walked into the hospital and he opened a briefcase. He'd never had a briefcase in his life before and said, I'll write you a check for whatever you want. He didn't even have any money in the bank.
How old was he?
Okay, he was 22. And he looked at his brother and he was so shocked. He just couldn't. And it's upset him to this day, the way that he saw him. Jonathan now has his doctorate in marine biology. And my second grandchild was born a year to the day of Scott's death at the same time of day that he died, she was born.
Amazing.
It's not Scott, It's just another gift. And I think it's a sign to say, aha, someone up there has a little control.
We're talking to Glennis Carl. We are also waiting for Andy Worthington, who is supposed to be talking to us about the Guantanamo files, stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. He has not been able to show up yet, so we will see what happens. You were talking about teaching children and how you would teach children. What about adults? What about family members? How do you work with them in hospice?
All right. In all different situations, it depends on their personalities. Some of them are very angry. They're angry at what has happened when they were younger with the family. And I have to tell them, well, come and touch. Sit by the person that you're losing and tell them, I didn't like that, what you did, but I forgive you. I'm sorry. It's an opportunity to say, to be truthful, to be really honest and open up. And
does the person in a case like that who's dying understand what they did wrong, even if they might not have before? For example, if they were abusive toward their child or their spouse or something.
Yes, they do. And I also try to intervene and say, you didn't know any better, because I didn't know what had happened to their parents as a child. Their parents may have been abusive to the mother who's dying, and she didn't know any better. History sometimes repeats itself, and people get closed off. They're very sensitive, and they have to make peace with themselves. Peace with, instead of carrying around the burden of not being able to say, well, you hurt me, just talking behind the book, well, she hurt me. But if you say it, but I forgive you, and I try to understand, it doesn't always happen. The scar is so deep. And for those people, they have a harder time.
Once the person's gone.
Yes. Or they have a harder time, I wish I had said that. I wish I'd have done that. I think that's why the bond is so strong between soldiers, because they hold each other. And they talk about the horrors that are going on. Or that's what happened in the Second World War, I heard. I hope it happens in this war, because this war is so instant with a lot of the bombs and the losing of limbs. But in the First World War and the Second World War, there was a bonding. They were hungry. They were holding each other. It's comfort. Holding is comfort.
What have you found that people who are involved with the death of family members or working in hospice bring to their life among the living?
I think... are you talking about how it changes them?
Yeah.
All right, you start living every moment as if it's very precious, and you concentrate on little things that make you laugh, that maybe didn't make you laugh so much before, or something that touches you, and the tears will come, and because of the tears then will come, it's a healing. You go on to the next thing. It's a hard thing to explain. It's like living in the moment and living and forgiving and doing the best you can and wanting to help, wanting to belong, wanting to be part of community.
I lost my father when I was 18 years old, and that process, it was not hospice. It was not full of all the things you're talking about, those moments of being able to understand and to say goodbye to the person and all of that. It was just an absolutely shattering experience, and I was shattered for years.
Well, you would be. Yes, you would be, because nobody talked to you. It's like this hush-hush thing. Oh, he's dying, and that's it. They don't bring you in and become a part of it. It's the scary thing. They don't tell you, well, this is the life he has lived, and go over some of the things that have made you laugh with your father, remembering and being able to talk to your dad, even though he's not responsive.
Glenys Carl is the author of Hold My Hand, A Mother's Journey, and once again, she will be speaking on Saturday, March 15th at 3 o'clock at Body of Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being on the air with us today.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please hold on. Welcome.
Hello there.
So how did you come to write this book that details information about so many of the individuals in Guantanamo?
Well, I think the first thing that happened was that when I decided that I wanted to investigate the story, I got quite lucky in a way. It was the spring of 2006, and that was the time when, you know, the prison had already been open for 4 years. And at that point, nobody even really knew who was in there. Obviously, some people had been released and their stories had come out, but the administration had not actually issued the names and nationalities of everyone who was in there. And when I started my research, that was when a lawsuit filed by the Associated Press went through, and the Associated Press won, and the Pentagon was forced to release the names and nationalities of the prisoners and 8,000 pages of transcripts of the tribunals that had taken place there, which were set up to establish whether they were correctly designated as enemy combatants. And the basis of the book really is a detailed analysis of those 8,000 pages of documents, which it seems that I was the only person who stuck with and went through and was able to extract a narrative and the stories of these people.
Tell us about this term, enemy combatant.
Well, enemy combatant was something really that was dreamt up by the administration, in the early stages of the assault on Afghanistan as a response to the 9/11 attacks. And essentially, what happened is that the administration decided that the two options that previously existed within the law, which was that people were either criminals, you know, within the U.S. court system, or were prisoners of war captured during wartime, that they weren't really happy with either of those categories, and that what they were searching for was a third category of prisoner who was beyond the law, which is where the designation of enemy combatant came in. And the way they established what they were going to do about capturing people was that the president was empowered to capture anybody that he suspected of terrorist involvement anywhere in the world, and hold them indefinitely, and if required, then subject them to a military trial, which was also something that didn't correspond either to U.S. law or to the military's own judicial processes.
One thing that you write about is that the Americans who captured these prisoners and interrogated them seem to have a great deal of trouble differentiating between terrorists, or this made-up designation, enemy combatants, on the one hand, and people who were charitable workers and religious teachers and just ordinary citizens who really weren't involved at all, on the other. Why? I mean, isn't that how intelligence people are trained, is precisely to make those kinds of distinctions?
Well, I think they are, yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, what we need to understand is that the fundamental problem here is that the majority of the prisoners who came into U.S. custody in Afghanistan were not actually captured on the battlefield by U.S. forces. Now, I know that that's something that the administration said from the beginning was that they were, but an analysis of the documents, not only the one I did, but one that was conducted by the Seton Hall Law School, you know, this is an analysis of the Pentagon's own documents, demonstrated that according to what they'd stated, the overwhelming majority of the prisoners who came into their custody were actually handed over to them by their Afghan or Pakistani allies. So, they obviously came with a story that they were told, but at that point it was very difficult to establish really whether the story that they'd been told when they were handed over was true or not. And another thing that I think is very important, which the military didn't do in this war, and which they had done previously in all wars from Vietnam onwards, was to hold battlefield tribunals. I mean, these are connected with Article 5 of the Geneva Conventions, which actually the U.S. had kind of developed in Vietnam as a kind of offshoot of the Geneva Conventions, specifically to weed out farmers and taxi drivers and people who were caught up accidentally in conflict, and to make sure that these people were released as soon as possible. And this was something that was completely overlooked for the first time. And that remains a kind of critical problem, was that there was no effective screening process, because once these people were in U.S. custody in Afghanistan, the lists of the prisoners went out to Camp Doha in Kuwait, which is where the top military brass and intelligence were. And they looked through the lists, and they basically weren't allowing any screening. Every single Arab who was captured under any circumstances, the requirement was that they were sent to Guantanamo, and this was the case with most of the Afghans as well.
You write about house raids and random arrests in Pakistan and I think elsewhere.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, this is another strand of the story that Pakistan was not the battlefield by any means, but there are certainly at least 120 of the prisoners were captured in Pakistan. And you know, so many of these people have subsequently been released, and it's been abundantly clear that a large number of these people were simply just rounded up. One of the reasons that they were particularly rounded up was because the U.S. military was offering bounty payments. Now, the figures that have been bandied around are an average of $5,000 a head for Taliban suspects and up to $20,000 a head for people who were suspected of belonging to al-Qaeda. And, you know, there was a very clear example, and I mean, this is only one out of many, but just before Christmas, two Sudanese prisoners were released back to Sudan, and one of these guys had been a hospital administrator for a humanitarian aid charity in Pakistan. He'd been living there for, I think, 17 years. And, you know, he was a very clear example of somebody who was just sold for opportunistic reasons. I mean, it's a terrible thing to have to say that this is what was happening, but this very clearly is what was going on.
To what extent do just pure racism and non-understanding of, you know, Muslim and Arabic cultures play a role in this whole fiasco?
Well, it certainly played a partial role. I mean, you know, given that the military, I think, started off from the presumption that basically any Arab who happened to be in Afghanistan, and Pakistan's obviously a different question, why people in Pakistan should be assumed that they were involved in anything. But even people in Afghanistan, the presumption was that any Arab who was there for military reasons. And I think the military had great difficulty understanding that some people were there because they were missionaries, and you know, and quite a significant number of other people had travelled there because they'd gone to perform humanitarian aid work. And now some of these people had gone out after the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan at the start of October 2001 because they'd seen reports and they'd heard reports of large numbers of Afghan refugees. And certainly the military seemed to have a problem understanding that that within Islam, one of the five pillars of Islam is an obligation to give a percentage of your annual income to charity. And not only that, but in times of a humanitarian crisis, such as a large refugee issue which was happening, that quite often people are encouraged that if they can take a bit of time off work, it's an even better thing to go out there personally and to, you know, to take money and to take essential items and distribute them to refugee camps. And this clearly is how dozens of people who ended up in Guantanamo were caught up. And during these tribunals in Guantanamo, there was a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of some of the officers, the military officers in the tribunals, that they simply couldn't comprehend how people would do this.
Unfortunately, it is time to go. Andy Worthington is author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. Thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can podcast. You can listen to the podcast at santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear it anytime you want to, including shows archived over a year back. And all of that thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today and for doing a marvelous job. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, John Greenspan with Good Morning Jazz, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.